Are the lights about to go out all across Australia? They could if they cross China. The incoming Trump administration seems like they're getting ready to stand up to China pretty robustly. But has Australia already given up too much control? We'll find out on today's Trumpet World. China has just about bought up control of Australia. That is the shocking conclusion of an upcoming article in our Trumpet print edition called The Lights Would Go Out on Australia. Here to tell us more about it is its author, Jeremiah Jacques. Jeremiah, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Palmer. Yes, thank you for having me on. I'd like to start off with just the energy assets that Australia has given China control over. And the list here is very alarming to see, but we can start with Alinta Energy. Alinta is a massive company with assets that include the Braemar Power Station in Queensland, and then the Bairnsdale Station in Victoria, also the Loy Yang B Power Station in Victoria, and then there's the Pinjarra Power Station in Western Australia, also the Wagerup Power Station, that one's in Western Australia as well. And Alinta also includes the Goldfields Gas Pipeline, a major pipeline there. So this is a huge company, more than 1.1 million households and businesses across Australia rely on it. They depend on it to endure extreme, you know, heat and cold, to prepare and preserve food, to operate banks and factories and all kinds of other facilities, and just for all of their numerous other energy needs.
So just before we get too far into that, I just want to ask, because this is a bit, I think, of a blind spot for us in a lot of ways, where we have quite a few viewers from down under. I think Australia is about our fourth most watched from location on YouTube, but it's a place I've never visited. And I feel like, you know, you named some big American energy companies, I will have probably heard of them. Big British energy companies, of course, I will have heard of them. Like Alinta, is this a name that most people in Australia will be nodding their heads and being like, oh yeah, I know them. They're my gas supplier, or they're my electricity supplier.
I imagine it is a name that many Australians would be familiar with, or if not Alinta, at least the subsidiary companies that operate, you know, beneath kind of the umbrella of the parent company there. I can't vouch for, you know, whether that name in itself is common knowledge among Aussies, but there are 1.1 million Australian, you know, businesses and households out of a population of 27 million total there that depend on it. And in 2017, the Australians sold it off to China's Chow Tai Fook Enterprises.
And this really is a big story. Like this whole overall, we're looking at China buying up Australia's assets, buying up control of Australia. And your article in the Trumpet print, I mean, that's one of the shocking things about it, is it just kind of, it goes on. It's this industry, it's this other industry. They've been allowed to buy so much. So I appreciate you kind of jumping right in, because we do have a lot of ground to cover. But as we get into some of the details of these energy companies, it is hard in this day and age to think of a company, a civilian company, more vital than energy. You know, like you were saying, heat and your ability to produce food, to cook through the winter, for factories to operate, for shops to open, to be able to then ship food across the country. If you're trusting another country with your energy, you are trusting them with a huge amount. And so, yes, we're getting into some of these specifics with these different energy companies, but it tells you so much about Australia's overall attitude towards China. Of yes, come on in, you can, you know, help yourself to whatever you want. It doesn't matter how strategic and how vulnerable we're making ourselves here.
For sure, yes. It is just a crucial sector of life that touches on almost every other sector of life, really, when you talk about the energy companies that we depend on. Exhibit A there is Alinta. Exhibit B that I wanted to talk about is Energy Australia. This one is even larger than Alinta. Its infrastructure includes the Hallett Power Station, Waterloo Wind Farm, Cathedral Rocks Wind Farm. Those are all in South Australia. And then in New South Wales, It owns Mount Piper Power Station, Pinedale Mine, and Tallawarra Power Station. And then in Victoria, the same company has the Yallourn Power Station as well. So Energy Australia is an enormous company. There are 1.7 million Australian homes and businesses that depend on it for their energy needs. But in 2011, this one was sold off to China Light and Power Company. And then it's the same situation with the Duet Group. Duet owns the tremendously important Dampier Bunbury pipeline. That's on Western Australia's Northwest Shelf. It also owns and operates the Wheatstone Ashburton West Pipeline, as well as the Fortescue River Gas Pipeline and Ashburton Onzo Gas Pipelines. Besides that, the Duet Group also owns vast swaths of the electricity distribution infrastructure that powers a great deal of Victoria. And in 2017, the Australians sold the Duet Group to a consortium led by China's Chung Kong Infrastructure. And then speaking of Chung Kong Infrastructure, this Chinese company also has 51% ownership of the SA Power Network. That's in South Australia. And it has 66% ownership of United Energy in Victoria. And it has a controlling stake in both Power Corp and City Power. These are all names that many Australians would be familiar with from the bills they, you know, receive in the mail each month. And then we can also talk here about a different Chinese company called the State Grid Corporation of China. After years of buying up Australian energy assets, they now own a massive transmission network for South Australia and Queensland. They also have a 49% stake in Electranet, and they have a controlling stake in Gemina. That's a company with energy infrastructure assets all throughout Australia's eastern states. So the list of Australian energy assets that are now owned by Chinese firms is long. It's alarmingly long, and it gets longer each year as the Aussies keep on selling this vital infrastructure off. And I wanted to mention that some Australians, you know, they might take comfort in the fact that most of these Chinese companies are privately owned in the democracy.
Right, and they're also different companies. I imagine that's a point that people would make as well is, okay, yes, they're owned by, but it's not one Chinese company buying up all of these. So do we really need to be concerned about different Chinese companies that are competing against each other, buying different Australian companies? Isn't that just how business works?
Exactly, yes. So many of these are private companies. And as you said, they're disparate companies. And if we were talking about the democracies of North America or Europe, private ownership would mean something. It would mean that a company is competing with other private companies. And to stay competitive, their main goal is to provide for the customers. You know, in America and Europe, that's what private ownership usually indicates. But with China, that is not at all the case. Under Chinese law, all Chinese companies, even if on paper they're privately owned, are beholden to the Chinese Communist Party, and they must obey its diktats. So all of these Chinese companies, really, they are all at the beck and call of the Chinese Communist Party, and that is a sobering reality for the Australians. And I'd like to read a little bit here about this from Australian analyst Clive Hamilton. He spoke to the Daily Mail about this recently, and he said that it means Australia's national security is under serious threat. He said, they are critical infrastructure and should not under any circumstances be under the control of the Chinese Communist Party. If Australia became involved in a conflict with China, for example, over Taiwan, then there is a high chance the Chinese government will shut down our energy supplies. And then he continues, the lights would go out, the banking system would seize up, there would be traffic chaos, petrol stations would be stranded. Why are we spending billions on sophisticated military equipment if we are at the same time making ourselves vulnerable to gray zone warfare? It makes no sense. And then he said the degree to which this dangerous sell-off of Australian energy assets to China is happening is, quote, genuinely shocking. Genuinely shocking.
Yeah, I mean, that was my response reading this article and getting this accumulation of evidence across all of these different sectors. And I think, you know, you're right to start with the energy because it is some of the most revealing. But yeah, like China almost owns this country now. I mean, I think you will get into it. We'll talk about some of it, but you know, you talk about ports, you talk about the way that Australia is just about surrounded by Chinese territory. And you know, we've been talking about Donald Trump's impact on Asia recently. Like this is going to be a major divide even between Australia and the United States, where you've got, I think a rightly so, more hawkish on China set of advisors and cabinet positions coming in under Donald Trump that do clearly see a threat posed by China. I mean, I wonder, this has kind of come up with New Zealand in the Five Eyes, where there's this very close intelligence sharing, military network, probably one of the closest alliances that exists on the planet today. And because of China's influence in New Zealand, there's been talk of like, well, is it really the Four Eyes? How much can we really trust New Zealand? You're going to, surely some of these new advisors would bring up similar questions now about Australia and people saying, well, do we need to give up on Australia? Is Australia too far gone? How much can we share with Australia? How much can we rely on Australia, given that if there is a conflict, their lights go out and we could well, you know, lose them as an ally if push comes to shove?
I think you're exactly right. There could be some difficult, you know, foreign policy discussions in the future between the U.S. and Australia, given just the extreme state of compromise that we see with Australia. And as you said there, it's not just the energy infrastructure. That may be the most visible aspect of this takeover. But at the same time, China has also slowly been taking over some of Australia's key ports. So first up is the port of Newcastle. This is a deep water harbor in New South Wales, and it handles the bulk of Australia's coal exports, more than 150 million tons each year. And that volume actually is larger than any other coal export port on the globe. And then Newcastle is also connected to the resource-rich Hunter Valley region of Australia. So this port is a key exporting hub for Australia's barley and wheat, as well as alumina and aluminum and steel and various industrial products. The port of Newcastle is also a vital node for bringing in petroleum products that end up being distributed all around Australia. So it's common knowledge that the port of Newcastle is among the most important locations in all of Australia. But in 2014, the Aussies gave a company called China Merchants Port Holdings control over it for a period of 98 years.
And this is, and then, just looking it up quickly, I think coal is Australia's number two export. Iron ore and other affiliated products are the number one export. And I think you mentioned, you know, steel and various industrial products going out of this port. So it's, you control this port and you have a bit of a chokehold on Australia's economy, certainly in terms of what they can sell around the world. Like, this is strategically, economically significant.
For sure, yes. And then next up is the famous Port Darwin. This is the most northerly water port in Australia. It's often called the gateway to Asia, because Darwin is a vital conduit for Australia's trade with Indonesia and Singapore and other nations in the region. And of course, it also connects Australia to the main global maritime routes. And Darwin handles a considerable amount of Australia's exports of oil, gas, zinc, lead, cattle, and agricultural products. And besides the economic significance, Darwin was also a major Australian military base during World War II. And for decades, it stood as just an inspiring symbol of Australia's military strength. But in 2015, the Chinese cash was just too enticing. And so the Australians handed it over to a Chinese firm called the Landbridge Group. And they now control Darwin on a 99-year lease. And then next up is the port of Melbourne. This is on the southern coast, and it's another crucial one. As the main gateway into Victoria, the port of Melbourne is vital for bringing in electronics and machinery and cars, and also for exporting food products and manufactured goods. And the volume here is astounding. The Port of Melbourne handles more than 3 million TEUs, or 20-foot equivalents, each year. And that makes it Australia's biggest container and general cargo port. Yet, in 2016, the Aussies let China Investment Corporation buy a significant percentage of the Port of Melbourne. And then we could also look at Port Hedland. That one's in Western Australia. This is among the nation's most critical maritime and industrial centers. Its location on the edge of one of the world's biggest iron ore producing areas, and also near vast caches of copper, gold, lithium, and salt, makes Port Hedland a natural export hub and a very important one. And it has a deep water harbor and just top tier infrastructure, which enable it to accommodate some of the world's largest shipping vessels. So Port Hedland is a pillar of Australia's economy, and it's an asset that cornerstone companies such as Fortescue Metals, Rio Tinto, and BHP all depend on heavily. But back in 2017, at the same time that Alinta Energy was sold to Chow Tai Fook Enterprises, Port Hedland was among those holdings that were handed over to the Chinese. So there we go. Several ports of importance have been given over to China, either in part or in whole. And it's just bewildering to see the Australians handing all of these over.
It is really amazing, these strategic assets. I think it's interesting, like there definitely seems to be an agenda on behalf of China and a laser focus on some of these very strategic areas that can give them a chokehold. Like you look at just the statistics without any colorful, like qualitative information, and China is not necessarily massive in terms of foreign direct investment. I think it's the fourth or the fifth. It's the fifth largest. It accounts for 4% of overseas investment coming into Australia. So 1/20th of outside companies coming in there and buying up Australian stuff is China. So there are other countries that are buying up and doing more to invest in Australia's economy than China is doing. But then you look at what China is buying, and they've really focused down that investment to these areas that really, like locking up control of a lot of these ports or really getting into the energy infrastructure, rather than kind of making a balanced investment across an area of sectors. They seem like they've really concentrated on just a few critical areas.
It's true. It does seem, you know, beyond coincidence when we see what the focus of these investments and acquisitions is. But, you know, China's takeover of Australia's energy infrastructure and its key ports, those two trends would be alarming enough, even if that's all that was going on. But at the same time, China is also establishing a presence at several locations in Australia's periphery, and these locations have major strategic military value. So I'd like to start here with a network that's being built, starting right inside of China itself and stretching all the way down to Australia. This starts with a high-speed railway that the Chinese have recently built, linking China's southwest region to the nation of Laos. This was under the framework of China's Belt and Road Initiative. So that connects China to Laos. And then the Chinese are following that up with a high-speed rail that links this line in Laos to Thailand's capital, Bangkok. And then when that one is complete, they plan to lay an additional line from Bangkok, stretching down through Malaysia and into Singapore. So this is just a remarkable distance being spanned here, especially when you consider the difficult terrain that it cuts through. Analyst Heather Chin emphasized the marvel of these interconnected projects back in March. She said, "Imagine jumping on a train in southwestern China, traveling some 2,000 miles and arriving in Singapore less than 30 hours later," end quote. So, you know, the extent of China's completed rails and planned rails is truly remarkable. And it's no secret that the same trains that can shuttle cargo and civilians from China down to this region just north of Australia could also transport troops. And the Chinese at present are even considering a couple of different very ambitious bridge projects that could connect this Southeast Asian rail network to Indonesia. This would be an incredibly difficult feat, building a bridge here, but it would connect all of this rail to all of the high-speed rail that China has already built in Indonesia, linking some of the nation's largest cities. And that rail, of course, would also link to the ports in Indonesia that China has taken control over. So that would be just a stunning accomplishment there. But even if the bridge plans never materialize, China's navy and merchant fleet, both of which are the largest in the world, could always pick up where the rail ends if they were moving lots of troops quickly around this area. So anyway, that's China's presence in Indonesia and the nations north of it. But if we continue east of Indonesia, we come to Papua New Guinea. And in 2018, China enticed Papua New Guinea's leaders to join the Belt and Road Initiative. And they built billions of dollars worth of infrastructure there as part of that deal. And then about 5 years later, the Chinese came knocking. They said they wanted to help with Papua New Guinea's policing and security. So this is basically China saying, yes, we built many roads and bridges for you, and now we want you to open your borders to us and let us station our military here. So in recent years, Papua New Guinea has signed a defense cooperation agreement with the United States, and they signed a security deal with Australia. And those two agreements could complicate China's designs on the nation. But as we've seen with other countries that have signed up for China's Belt and Road Initiative, China now holds considerable leverage over Papua New Guinea, and that could enable them to force the Anglo nations out. Next, we come to Solomon Islands. That's off of Australia's east coast. In 2022, Solomon Islands alarmed the Western world by signing a wide-ranging security pact with China. This deal actually allows China to send police and armed units and military personnel and other law enforcement to Solomon Islands, and it could even allow China to dock naval ships on Solomon Islands' coast. So that's Solomon Islands, and the list here just goes on and on, with the Chinese also using their easy cash to bolster their power over such nations as Timor-Leste, Kiribati, Tonga, Vanuatu, and Fiji. So it's clear that China is spending a great deal of money and exerting a great deal of effort in order to economically colonize this region. And I'd like to read just a little bit here from the U.S. Institute of Peace. This is an analysis they published in 2022. It says, China's pursuit of greater military reach in the Pacific Islands draws parallels to Imperial Japan's construction of bases prior to World War II. And the implications are likewise strikingly similar. A Chinese military presence in the Pacific Islands could complicate transit between Australia and the United States, allow Beijing to increase its power projection in the second and third island chains, and bring Chinese military firepower closer than ever to Australian and U.S. territory, end quote. And then the Australian government published a similar analysis in a recent defense white paper. They wrote, quote, Australia cannot be secure if our immediate neighborhood, including Papua New Guinea, Timor-Leste, and Pacific Island countries, becomes a source of threat to Australia. This includes the threat of foreign military power seeking influence in ways that could challenge the security of our maritime approaches, end quote. So the authors of these sources, they are among the many clear-eyed analysts who recognize that China's maneuvering in this region poses a serious threat to vital shipping lanes there. And they see that if China can continue its slow takeover of the maritime locations that allow control over these lanes, and if it can militarize them, as it has done with other locations, then China could block the transit of Australia's allies, specifically the United States, and it could isolate Australia. And when that possibility is placed alongside the assets that China has already taken control over across Australia, you know, the energy assets and the ports that we've spoken about, then the danger of all these converging trends becomes very stark.
And it is a danger not just to Australia. And, you know, we've talked about this, I think, before we had this show in video form, where some will look at what China is doing with its ports and kind of say, well, this isn't all that different to what America was doing, say, under Theodore Roosevelt in the Caribbean, and getting control of the immediate waters around it in the same way that China is now getting control of the South China Sea, making sure that it can't be itself blocked off and blockaded by a foreign power. And that's kind of step one to then being able to project yourself around the world. You've got to be secure in your own backyard. You've got to make sure that someone else can't come and blockade you before you can start projecting power. And this was really, you know, this was Theodore Roosevelt's, one of his great contributions to the rise of the United States as a global power, even before he was in the presidency, with triggering the war with Spain, getting control of Cuba. Then when he was in the White House, pushing for the Panama Canal, and some of these big infrastructure projects, which then allows the U.S. military to concentrate and not be kind of divided by, you know, to overcome some of the limits of geography so that its fleet isn't divided by this big, you know, North and South America being in the way and can face any aggressor. You do see parallels in what is going on in China, the way that they are getting control of their island chains around them, the way that they are producing some of their own vast infrastructure projects to get around some of the constraints that geography has placed on them, or to turn some of those constraints into opportunities and overcoming limitations that they've had in the past. You know, this, I think, is huge behind some of this Belt and Road Initiative. Like, you go back to the way that during World War II, Japan was able to gain control of the coasts and cut off the interior of China from the rest of the world. And it was very difficult for the U.S. military to get in support and aid to Chiang Kai-shek and to keep the Chinese nationalists in the war fighting against Japan. China's learned that lesson. They want to make sure they can't be cut off easily again. That's part of the reason why they have a rail link to Singapore. And now, whether it's they're worried about Japan, whether they're worried about the United States, they can't be cut off by having their coast cut off in that regard. So there are people that say, well, you know, it's the same. But I think it's important to stop and note, well, you know, countries are not just the same. Countries are not identical. Countries have different values, and it's not multiculturalism where everyone's values and ideals have equal worth and produce equal outcomes. You look at some of the news we've had out of China just this week, where they've been sentencing people. We had the sentencing for those in Hong Kong either just today or yesterday, where 45 pro-democratic activists were sentenced to prison in a court that was essentially rigged. They weren't given trial by jury. There were three judges appointed to make sure that these political prisoners went to jail. This was a country where, you know, Hong Kong, until recently, people lived in a state of freedom and free speech. I mean, maybe more so than, say, we have in Britain right now, with the way the government is trying to crack down on hate crime. And that's been very quickly overturned by China. This is a country with very different values. And so, okay, yes, it's treading in the same footsteps that America has trodden before. That shouldn't be a cause to go to sleep and say they're not doing anything. Like, that should make, that should alarm us, that another, a nation with these values that has, what, 2 million people in concentration camps, that is producing cheap goods via slave labor and exporting them all around the world, that doesn't value free speech, that is using a lot of incredible technology to produce arguably the most dystopian society on the planet right now, where you have to watch what you say in private conversations, where the police can track you down in any moment of time, where you go to you go to some of the Xinjiang or something with the Uyghurs in northwest China, and you can't, like, every knife is stamped with a QR code so the government can track every single knife, smartphone. You can't communicate with anyone electronically, and then with microphones placed around so often, even not electronically. There is no freedom of religion. They're editing the Bible. There's no freedom of thought. Like, the fact that this power is treading the path to global superpower status that the United States trod, that should terrify a whole lot more than just New Zealand and Australia.
You're exactly right. And I'm glad that you brought those matters up. It is extremely dark in China already. And the Chinese Communist Party would like to really make the entire world be under their control, to bring that darkness everywhere. And the Bible prophecy shows that this is all leading to some very dark days for Australia. So they will end up exporting more of their vision. Their power will grow. But you could really start in Genesis 22:17. This is a passage where God promised the patriarch Abraham that his descendants would one day be blessed by taking possession of the gates of their enemies. That's the way it reads in the International Standard Version. And the late Herbert W. Armstrong proved that these descendants are the peoples of America and Britain, including British Commonwealth countries such as Australia. These nations are the modern day descendants of Abraham through his son Isaac, his grandson Israel, and Israel's son Joseph. And Mr. Armstrong showed that this promise recorded here in Genesis 22:17 was fulfilled before World War II. That's when the US and Britain came to control all of the major sea gates on the globe, such as Hong Kong, as you mentioned there a moment ago, and the Panama Canal, Suez Canals. And they also came to control numerous minor sea gates, such as Solomon Islands and Fiji and Papua New Guinea and Vanuatu. So based on this verse in Genesis 22 and related passages, Mr. Armstrong wrote in his book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, that the fact that Britain and the U.S. came to control these strategic maritime locations actually proved that these countries are the descendants of Abraham's family. So it's a remarkable fact. And history shows that America and Britain used their control over these various seagate locations to defeat aggressor powers during both world wars, including a major campaign from the Solomon Islands during World War II. That resulted in a major loss for Japan. And then in peacetime, the U.S. and Britain used their control over these locations to keep the world's shipping lanes open and relatively stable. And that was to the benefit of most all nations. So it's a very, very different overall attitude that you see from the U.S. and Britain than you would from a nation like China under the Chinese Communist Party's leadership. But the Bible also prophesied that Britain and the U.S. would later lose their hold on these vital sea gates. We can see this in Deuteronomy 28:52, where it shows God warning the descendants of Abraham that if they refuse to obey him, then he would cause their enemies to take control over these gates and to weaponize that control against them. So for this tragedy to come to pass, the U.S. and Britain first had to lose control over those gates that they had previously been blessed with. And this has happened. In recent decades, so many of these holdings, such as the Panama Canal, Hong Kong, Solomon Islands, and the Suez Canal, have been transferred from America and Britain to other nations, mostly China. And this is leading to a very troubling outcome. Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury explains this in his book, Isaiah's End Time Vision. He shows that China and some of its partners in the near future, including Russia and even European countries, will use their control over these sea gates against the modern descendants of Israel. He writes, considering that China has come to possess most of the world's strategic sea gates, which ironically at one time were held by Britain and America, we believe there may be a brief alliance between the German-led Holy Roman Empire and certain Asian powers, Russia, China, Japan. Should Europe, the resurrected Holy Roman Empire, find a way to take advantage, even for a moment, of key resources and strategic holdings of China, Russia, and Japan, it would have more than enough power to besiege the Anglo-Saxon nations and enslave them. End quote. So there's quite a lot in that quote, quite a lot to unpack, but it's all based on Mr. Fleury's understanding of Bible prophecy. And for Australia, with so many of its critical energy assets and ports already under Chinese control, and with so many Chinese footholds being established in the periphery of Australia, I think it's especially easy to see how this kind of besiegement could happen. You know, we spoke a moment ago about Australian analyst Clive Hamilton. He's been warning about specifically the danger of China's control over Australia's energy assets. And he warned that all the Chinese would have to do is decide to flip the switch, and then millions of Aussie homes and businesses would suddenly be in the dark. The banking system would be frozen. You'd have traffic pandemonium. And his warning makes clear, of course, that this would just cause extreme chaos for the Australian people. But imagine if China timed its flipping of that chaos switch to happen a day or two before it sent some of its 1.4 billion people, maybe on some of that high-speed rail, to confront Australia's 27 million people. And imagine if the Chinese were simultaneously using their control of Australia's ports and the gates and shipping lanes in the region to block Australia's partners from coming in to help. And then finally, imagine if China did all of this with assistance from Russia, Japan, and some of the nations of Europe. When you put all this together, you see that a besiegement and invasion of Australia is not as unthinkable as many would like to believe. And Mr. Fleury's book makes clear that the lights will soon go out. He shows that the decline of the US, Britain, and British Commonwealth nations, and the rise of China and other revisionist powers is leading to a war that will contribute to an era of unprecedented catastrophe for all countries. But it's not all bad news. His book makes clear that the suffering actually has a profound purpose, and that is to teach the nations to love God's law. And Mr. Fleury stresses that that time of suffering will be rapidly followed by a new dawn, a time of unprecedented radiance and peace. And he shows that it's all really to help people learn that God's way is the only way. He writes, "Thank God that there is great news beyond the bad news."
So I want to talk maybe a bit about that conclusion again, just in a couple of minutes. But I think it's also worth just looking at, like, we've looked in detail at this, but it's not just a Chinese Australia problem. And I think the prophecy that you've uncovered brings that out, that it's not just about Australian sea gates, and it's not just that Australia is involved in this siege, that they're definitely a major component of it. But this is about bringing down the United States, Britain. Obviously, I think there is a unique dimension to Australia because they're so far away. They're nowhere near the North Atlantic. And you look at what is going on in a lot of these countries, and this is a very widespread weakness. Maybe less so, perhaps, the United States, but certainly here in Britain, we'll sell a lot of our strategic energy companies, perhaps not to China, but we'll sell them to European powers that you just brought in there. And I think we've got E.ON, and there's a lot of French and German powers invested in Britain's energy infrastructure. I think even British gas might be owned by a German company, or they were at some point. These all get bought and sold a lot. But you never see the reverse. Like, you try and buy a big German company, and the government will more often than not find a way to block you. They do not allow these to go up for sale. If you were to think about trying to buy a Chinese energy company, well, you could just completely forget about it. It doesn't work that way. The Chinese Communist Party does not allow you to invest in China in the same way they invest in everywhere else. So I think that brings to life this whole other set of Bible prophecies as well about, Hosea talks about Britain being a silly dove, or Ephraim, it says, is a silly dove. Like, there's just a complete lack of common sense. And there is this kind of living in this fantasy world where we don't need to worry about foreign countries buying up infrastructure, that we're all just out to make money, and that's what's going to predominate, and we can trust them to just do what's in their own economic interest and to keep trying to make money. And the idea that somebody would really use that from even more dramatic leverage and to bring about even more dramatic results, well, that doesn't really enter the equation at all. And so it's a consequence of a lot of foolish thinking in Australia, but also far beyond.
I agree, and I'm glad that you mentioned the silly dove passage there. It really does seem like an apt description of the kind of thinking that would allow this slow takeover of such vital infrastructure to be happening. And as you said, this is not just Australia. I think it's probably the easiest location where we can see China's takeover and its surrounding sort of peripheral buildup there. But through the Belt and Road Initiative, China is establishing a serious presence in over 100 nations around the world. So if you look at Latin America and the Caribbean, China's influence there is deepening very quickly, and that has major implications for the US's security as well. And of course, it's also happening in Africa and throughout Asia and even in some European nations as well. So yes, this is Australia, I think, is where we can see it the most starkly at present, but it doesn't mean that America and Britain are safe from these trends.
That's a really good point about Latin America. And we recently saw, Xi Jinping going around and opening up these major ports and things like that, even in Latin America. I think one of the ways Australia stands out is it is a Western, like, wealthy nation. In some ways, it feels more understandable say, for somewhere like Sri Lanka, where the government has just absolutely messed that country up and they're desperate for cash. I mean, there's a lot of corruption going on there. I mean, it kind of, the blame for that fits very squarely on some corrupt leaders, I think. You look at somewhere like Kenya or Tanzania, they're poor, they're castrated. Like, you can kind of understand why they might turn to China for some of that. Where you've got Australia, where it's a rich, stable democracy, you can't really, I don't think, cast the blame off to one family that has dominated politics. It's quite clearly more than just, hey, we're a really impoverished country and we're desperate for anyone to come give us cash. It just feels a lot more of a foolish decision coming from somewhere like Australia. And I'm absolutely sure that there is a component of elites doing this against the will of the people. I think we see that dynamic in a lot of different countries, but not so starkly as it is somewhere that is just thoroughly corrupt or was like Sri Lanka. So that, I think, really does make this story in Australia stand out as well. They don't need to do this. They didn't have to do it this way, but they have. But I'm glad you also brought up the Seagates part of this, because that is just such a specific Bible prophecy that God said, well, Israel, descendants of Abraham, you're going to have control over the gates of your enemies. You're going to have control over these vital choke points, these vital geographic intersections that you really need to control world trade. There's some incredible geopolitical, and like nobody else, no human at the time that Abraham was alive was really thinking, well, controlling various different maritime choke points is going to be the key to wealth and prosperity 4,000 years in the future. But that's how it turned out. Those scriptures have been fulfilled just in very dramatic detail. And Mr. Armstrong talks about, well, you could find the descendants of Abraham just by looking at who owns these sea gates. And it really has been an incredible fulfilled prophecy that just a small group of nations have ended up monopolizing control over most of the world's choke points. But those same prophecies, like the one in Deuteronomy 28, says, well, they're going to go and they're going to be taken over by your enemies and they're going to besiege you. They're going to use the same gates that you held against you. So we're seeing that fulfilled in specific detail, but then that detail in itself points us back to God. It points us to the fact that this isn't just random chaos. Yes, there are very flawed human decisions and flawed systems of government and greed. Yes, all of that is involved here. But behind all of that as well, God is in control. He forecasts what would happen. He is measuring the punishment. He is overseeing the punishment. And he said exactly how it will happen. And so he's allowing it to happen in a specific order, in a specific way, all in part of his goal to reach mankind. And he is working to reach Britain. He's working to reach the United States. We've got a warning going out to Europe. And he is warning, he's punishing Australia as well. And the whole world he is going to warn, the whole world he's going to reach. And it's all part of a plan for him to reach everyone. And I think the fact that Bible prophecies tie so specifically into those sea gates is a fantastic signpost that, yeah, when you're talking about an enemy, a country like China, that is more dark and dystopian than we like to think about right now, and what they could do to Australia. And you really think about that, that is pretty depressing. But in these sea gates, there is this blinding light that points you to God as well, and that this is all about repentance and change and then bringing in a wonderful new world where we get away with getting to the selfishness and the silly ideas that have brought us to this point, and having the whole world just joyfully subject to God and his laws. Well, thank you so much for joining us for that, Jeremiah. I think that we have a wonderful group of loyal listeners down under in Australia. Philippines, I think, is another area where we have quite a lot of listeners from. We'll definitely have to do a show, I think, where we focus on some Philippine stories. We really enjoyed spending some time with you guys when we did our live show. I think it must have been a good time when Joshua and I were talking in the morning about the election results in the United States. I think we had quite a few Australians joining us in the live chat for that. So finally, we've talked about something in your backyard. I'm sure we will revisit that. Jeremiah, thank you so much for bringing that to us. Thank you to George Haddad and Isaac Lorenz for engineering and production. You can email us. You can get in touch at thetrumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. You can get in touch with us by leaving a comment on YouTube or in Rumble. And we will be right back as usual on Friday for our weekend review show. And until then, keep watching your world.